Dogs barked and strained on leashes, terrifying the children. Mothers cradled babies, and fathers picked up toddlers. Nazis brandishing weapons separated the men from the women and children, sending the men to the east and women to the west side of the barracks. Husbands and wives reached for each other, crying at being torn apart. Children screamed for fathers and grandfathers. They were forced to split up at gunpoint or menaced with the butts of rifles.
What's happening?
The Nazis are separating men from women.
And Sandro?
He and his father are getting in lines for the barracks. Marco waited to see which barracks Sandro and his father were assigned to. Soon they were shoved in front of the third barracks from the east and forced to line up outside. The barracks had a white sign that Marco couldn't read.
Please, can I see?
Yes, he's in front of the third barracks from the end on the left. Marco handed her the binoculars. Each barracks has a white sign. What number is their barracks?
Elisabetta raised the binoculars.
I see him, and he still has the basil. I wonder if he got my note.
What number is their barracks?
15. I wish we could go in there right now.
Not until nightfall. Stay with the plan.
Oh no, something's the matter with his face, Elisabetta moaned. Do you think they beat him?
Marco felt enraged at the thought. It was time for action, and tonight couldn't come soon enough.
Chapter 128. Elisabetta. 18th October, 1943. A cloud cloaked the moon, and Elisabetta and Marco hurried ahead in utter darkness. Their clothes were dark, so they blended in. They raced across an open pasture to the east side of the transit camp. There were no grapevines or ravines in which to hide, and they were vulnerable, covered only by night. They approached the transit camp, crouching down. They stopped at a tall umbrella pine tree near the back entrance, close to Sandro's barracks. The transit camp was quiet. The prisoners were inside the barracks, asleep at this hour. The Nazi guards stood at their regular posts. Elisabetta couldn't see their faces under their helmets, but it didn't matter if she remembered them. It mattered only if they remembered her, from when she had pretended to be a country girl carrying wine. Elisabetta and Marco split up at the umbrella pine without exchanging a word. There was nothing to say, and they both knew the plan. She stayed behind the tree while Marco ran to the construction site on the west side of the transit camp. There was no perimeter fence around the construction site, and it was unguarded at night. A few lamps there had been wired on posts, but they weren't lighted. Elisabetta crouched behind the tree, hidden. Marco would reach the site any minute now. He would set a small fire, which would grow, giving him time to get back to her. She was supposed to count off 5 minutes, then go into action. Her heart pounded in her chest, and she forced herself to count slowly. She told herself to stay calm. She would do whatever it took to save Sandro. She didn't see Marco, but she had to trust that he would come in time. She counted to 2 minutes, then 3, 4, and 5. It was time.
Hey, you, Elisabetta called to the nearest Nazi guard, stepping out from behind the tree with a smile. The Nazi raised his gun, and a bolt of fear coursed through her body.
It's only me, she called out, waving.
The Nazi lowered his gun, and Elisabetta breathed easier, remembering the German phrases Marco had taught her.
I remember you, handsome. Do you remember me?
Natürlich,
the Nazi answered, keeping his voice low. He glanced behind him, checking to see if anyone was watching them.
I like you the best. I need a man.
Elisabetta struggled through her fear to remember the German words.
I'm so lonely.
The Nazi stood still, neither answering nor moving. Elisabetta held her breath, not knowing what to do. She had to improvise. She pulled up her skirt in the front, leaving no mistake about her meaning.
Please, I like you the best. I need a man. I'm so lonely.
The Nazi turned in the direction of the other guard, then shouted to him in rapid German. Elisabetta prayed to God he wasn't informing on her. The other guard only nodded, so evidently he wasn't. The Nazi started walking toward the back exit of the transit camp, then let himself out of the gate, unbuckling his belt as if he had to go to the bathroom. Elisabetta slipped back behind the tree, watching the Nazi come closer. Her heart thundered in her chest. She checked the construction site. She couldn't see if the fire had started. She could only hope Marco was on his way back to her. The Nazi made a terrifying silhouette advancing on her, backlit. She wanted to scream, but instead she forced a naughty giggle. The Nazi's shadow loomed larger. She could hear him chuckling in excitement. His belt jingled and he unzipped his pants. Elisabetta struggled to control her panic. The Nazi was almost there, saying something in German. She was supposed to reach out her arms, but she was too frightened. She didn't see Marco anywhere. The Nazi embraced her roughly. He kissed her hard on the mouth, tasting of cigarettes. His hand slipped under her dress, sliding up her thigh to her underwear. She forced herself not to struggle. The Nazi thrust his tongue into her mouth. Tears came to her eyes. The Nazi leaned her back, then pressed her to the ground. Elisabetta scrambled backward, stalling. The Nazi thought she was teasing. He scrambled after her, chuckling. He gripped her arm, pulled her under him, and climbed on her with his full weight. Suddenly, the Nazi's head was jerked backward. His body was lifted off of her. Marco materialized above the Nazi, grabbing his head. The Nazi's eyes widened with fear. Marco twisted the Nazi's head deftly, breaking his neck with a crunch of vertebrae. Elisabetta rolled away, swallowing her horror. The Nazi collapsed, dead.
Chapter 129. Marco, 18th of October, 1943. Marco walked toward the back exit of the transit camp. He kept his face down under the dead Nazi's helmet. The Nazi's uniform fit him well, and he buckled his belt as he approached the transit camp, as if he'd urinated. The Nazi guard opened the gate for him, and Marco grunted his thanks. He entered the transit camp, crossed to the dead Nazi's post, and stood on guard. He glanced toward the construction site, praying that the fire grew soon. He had set it near some electrical wire behind a pile of bricks, then mixed inflammable solvent and oily rags. The fire wouldn't show until it was blazing, and the Nazis would assume it was negligence rather than intentional. He didn't want it to look like sabotage, or they would lock down the transit camp. Marco stood behind Sandro's barracks, which were quiet. The plan was working so far. He had gotten to Elisabetta in time. She had looked terrified, but she had done the job. He checked the umbrella pine, knowing she would be hiding behind it, recovering. He shifted his gaze to the construction site. He noticed a faint orange brightness behind the pile of bricks. The rags must have caught fire. They were beginning to burn. Marco turned, patrolled Sandro's barracks, and peered in the windows as he had seen the Nazis do. He glanced in the first window, then the second. The only thing he could discern in the gloom were sleeping forms in rough wooden rows of beds. He had been hoping to spot Sandro inside, but it was too dark. Marco passed the third window and heard snoring, a distinctly human sound that wrenched his heart. He wished he could save every one of them. He returned to his post. He glanced at the construction site.
The brightness was growing. None of the Nazis was looking in that direction. "War is waiting," he thought of his father saying. Marco's first impulse was to suppress thoughts of his father, but instead he used the memory to strengthen him. Surely his father was with him now, watching over him. Everything that he'd learned about right and wrong, about justice and injustice, came from his father. Tonight, Marco prayed he would do justice. Chapter 130. Marco, 18th of October, 1943.
"Fire!"
yelled a Nazi. Panic rippled through the guards. All of the helmeted heads turned to the construction site. The Nazis ran to the fire, which had ignited the solvent and rags. Orange flames raged into the sky, licking the night air.
"Fire! Fire!"
Marco joined in with flawless German. He pointed at the fire. The Nazis around him left their posts and ran where he pointed. Marco ran to Sandro's barracks and tore open the door. The men inside recoiled in terror. But he couldn't reveal he wasn't a real Nazi. He couldn't risk how the men would react. Nothing could go wrong now.
"Get back!" Marco shouted in German.
He looked wildly around for Sandro and his father. Men huddled together, cowering in fear. He spotted Sandro against the wall with Massimo, who was putting on his glasses.
"You, come with me!"
Marco rushed to them, grabbing Sandro in one hand and Massimo in the other. He hustled them to the door and scanned the camp to see if it was safe to leave. All of the Nazi guards were at the construction site trying to put out the fire. Some tried blankets, others water. There was no time to lose.
"Sandro, Massimo,"
Marco whispered, leading them outside.
"Come with me, hurry."
"Marco?"
Sandro's mouth dropped open. He took his father's arm.
"Papa, he's getting us out of here."
"But I can't walk on my ankle."
Massimo limped.
"It's worse than before."
"We have to go." Marco glanced at the construction site. The fire raged higher, and the Nazis tried to put it out. The conflagration burned bright. No one was looking their way. Massimo turned to Sandro, stricken.
"Son, go without me. I'm too slow. I can't keep up."
Sandro shook his head.
"Papa, I can't leave you."
"You must go. I love you."
"Massimo, please."
Marco looked over, frantic. "Marco, take Sandro."
Massimo's eyes glistened.
"Do it for me, I beg you."
"No,"
Sandro insisted. But Massimo wrenched his arm from his son's grasp and darted back inside the barracks.
"Papa!"
Sandro started to go after him.
"Sandro, come with me, now."
Marco grabbed Sandro's arm, giving him no choice. The Nazis were at the fire. They were still preoccupied, but it wouldn't last long. Marco yanked Sandro to the exit, tore open the gate, and swung it closed. He kept his grip on Sandro and ran him to the umbrella pine. Elisabetta showed herself, taking Sandro's hand.
"Sandro!"
"Elisabetta?" Sandro asked, shocked. But there was no time for conversation. Marco, Sandro, and Elisabetta raced into the darkness. Chapter 131. Sandro, 18th of October, 1943. Sandro's eyes filled with tears as they ran from the transit camp. Elisabetta held his one arm and Marco held the other, propelling him forward. He felt agonized at having abandoned his father. Guilt buckled his knees, weakening him. He knew he should go with Marco and Elisabetta, but he wanted to turn and run back.
"My father..."
Sandro couldn't finish the sentence.
"We had no choice. We could have made him come."
"No."
"We could have tried."
"No, Sandro. He never could have made this run. We have to run for the next hour, over pastures and vineyards. It's too much for him."
"They won't retaliate against him, will they?"
"Did they check your names when they assigned you to the barracks?"
"No, they only counted heads."
"So they don't know who you are. Your father is a brilliant man. He'll take care of himself."
Elisabetta squeezed his hand, and her grip gave Sandro the strength to keep running. Tears streamed down his cheeks. All around him was pitch black. His legs felt weak. His breath turned ragged. His heart pounded with exertion. He struggled to keep up.
"Sandro, listen," Marco said as they ran. "The Nazis will realize a guard is missing. They'll find the dead guard with ease. They're going to search the transit camp and the houses in Fossoline Carpi. We can't stay in the area."
"Right," Sandro said, his chest heaving.
"We can't go to Carpi train station. That's what they expect."
"So where are we going?"
"South, to the train station at Modena. The last train to Rome is in 1 hour and 15 minutes. We timed your escape to make the train. If we miss it, we'll have to hide overnight."
"Okay."
Sandro got the message. They had to make the train. It was life or death.
"I don't think the Nazis from Fossoli will be sent to Modena. They can't spare men."
"There could be Nazis in Modena."
"I know. I have false papers for you. Your new name is Giovanni Longhi."
"After Professoressa Longhi."
Sandro remembered the math teacher, a lifetime ago. "I have a change of clothes for you, too. When we get to the train station, we split up. Act like we don't know each other. You and Elisabetta will go together. You'll be a couple."
Elisabetta looked over at Sandro. "We are a couple."
Marco was barely panting. "I'll keep an eye on you two, but you're on your own."
"Will the Nazis at Modena know there was an escape?"
"Yes, I assume so. My hope is they'll expect us to hide around Fossoli rather than try to run to Modena. So we have surprise going for us again. If we just keep traveling south across the fields, we'll be fine."
Elisabetta squeezed Sandro's hand. "This is all Marco's plan. How to get you out of the camp? Everything."
"Not true." Marco looked over. "Elisabetta makes great pasta."
"What?"
Sandro asked breathlessly.
"Marco, thank you.
I don't know how I can repay you."
"Take care of her. That's how."
Chapter 132. Elisabetta, 18th October 1943. Elisabetta held Sandro's hand, and they walked through the cobblestone streets of Modena toward the train station. Marco was a block ahead of them, and men and women passed them. She had shaken the dirt from her shoes, and Sandro had changed into Marco's white shirt and dark pants, cinched by a belt. He looked fine, except for the welt on his right cheek from a Nazi blow. Elisabetta felt terrible about leaving Massimo behind, and Sandro was somber. Ahead, Marco joined the people heading into the station, a long square building with a series of arches at its entrance. She realized that he would have a hard time finding their platform since he couldn't read train schedules. She hoped he would figure it out or ask someone. Elisabetta and Sandro crossed the street and entered the train station. The ceiling was vaulted, and it was a large space, with doors on the far side that led to the platforms and tracks. There were only a handful of travelers carrying valises and newspapers. Luckily, there were no Nazis in sight.
"Giovanni, let's check the track number," Elisabetta said, using Sandro's false name in case anyone overheard.
He pursed his lips, and she could tell he was nervous, so she squeezed his hand. Sandro eyed the schedule.
"Our train will be here any minute, on track 7. We're right on time."
"Good."
Elisabetta glanced over to see Marco passing through the door to the platforms.
"Let's wait outside, shall we? It's a nice night, and I'm sure we can pay on the train."
"Good idea."
Sandro forced a smile and they headed outside. They crossed to the platform for track 7. Their train approached, its round light rumbling toward them. The travelers perked up and formed a rough line.
Elisabetta's heart filled with happiness. All she and Sandro had to do was board and act like a couple in love, which they were. They were almost home.
Suddenly, two Nazis emerged from the train station, smoking cigarettes.
She spotted them out of the corner of her eye, but kept her smile in place.
Sandro must have seen them too.
He stiffened, turning away.
Elisabetta worried about him. On impulse, she kissed him.
He kissed her back, surprised at first. Then she felt him catch fire. She pressed herself against him, feeling all the love she had for him.
I love you,
Sandro murmured when he released her.
I love you too,
she told him. The train pulled into the station, its engine grinding and wheels slowing rhythmically. The other travelers to Rome lined up to board, flowing around them. She kept Marco in her sight, and he lingered to the side and behind them, pretending to read a newspaper. She knew he had seen the two Nazis and wouldn't board until after she and Sandro did, making sure they were safe. The Nazis walked toward the platform, apparently to board the train. They chatted and smoked in a relaxed manner. But Sandro stared straight ahead, his back ramrod straight.
Elisabetta felt alarm at Sandro's reaction and glanced at Marco.
Their eyes connected, and she knew he was having the same concern. In the next moment, Marco set his newspaper on the bench. The line of travelers shifted forward, boarding the train. Elisabetta and Sandro moved up, but Sandro kept his face front. The Nazis joined the line behind them, laughing together as if they had shared a joke. Elisabetta didn't understand what they were saying, and Marco was too far away to hear.
Sandro kept staring straight ahead.
Elisabetta caressed his arm, trying to reassure him. Marco shifted closer to the two of them, slipping off his backpack.
Elisabetta knew Marco had a gun inside.
The line moved forward. Elisabetta stepped closer to the train, and so did Sandro. The Nazis followed. Then one of them spoke to Sandro.
Chapter 133. Marco, 18th of October, 1943. Marco slipped his hand inside his backpack. His fingers encircled the handle of his gun. He forced himself to wait. Two Nazis were standing behind Sandro and Elisabetta. One of the Nazis was saying something to Sandro, trying to get his attention. Sandro stood oddly stiff. Marco moved close enough to hear what they were saying. The first Nazi chuckled.
Did your girlfriend hit you?
He asked Sandro in broken Italian. Sandro turned around stiffly. He didn't laugh. His mouth went tight.
No, I got hurt when
he fell down the steps, Elisabeth interjected with a sly grin. If I hit him, it would leave a bigger mark. The Nazis burst into laughter. Sandro managed to smile, but it was shaky. Marco placed his finger on the trigger. The first Nazi winked at Elisabetta.
I don't believe you. I think you did hit him. Like this.
The second Nazi cocked his arm and pretended to punch Sandro. But Sandro flinched in reflexive fear. The first Nazi's smile faded.
What are you so worried about?
The second Nazi eyed Sandro hard.
Show us your identity card.
Of course.
Sandro put his hand in his pocket, produced the false card and held it out, but his hand trembled visibly. Elisabetta stiffened. Marco kept his finger on the trigger. The Nazi made no move to take the card. Instead, he watched Sandro's hand shake, prolonging the excruciating moment. The conductor appeared in the stairwell of the train.
All aboard! All aboard!
The Nazi gave the conductor a stern look. Hold the train. We're not ready to leave yet. The conductor nodded nervously, then disappeared. The Nazi lifted his gaze from the trembling card to Sandro. You seem very nervous. What are you hiding? What have you done? Sandro swallowed hard.
I haven't done anything.
Something tells me you have.
The Nazi snapped the card from Sandro's hand, skimmed it, and started to return it. But as soon as Sandro reached for the card, The Nazi pulled it back, toying with him. Sandro's hand shook, suspended in the air. Marco aimed his gun, still in the backpack. The Nazi pulled his pistol on Sandro. "You're coming with us." Marco withdrew his gun. The Nazi whipped around, aimed at Marco, and fired.
"No!"
Sandro threw himself in the path of the Nazi's bullet, and it struck him in the chest. Sandro's shirt exploded in blood. He flew backward through the air, his arms flailing. Elisabetta screamed in anguish. Marco shot both Nazis rapid fire. They dropped to the platform, dead.
"No!"
Elisabetta raced to Sandro, who lay bleeding on the platform. She threw herself on him, hugging him. She burst into tears, screaming and sobbing. Marco raced to Sandro's side in horror. Sandro's blue eyes faced heavenward, fixed. His body was utterly motionless. Sandro was gone, his blood leaking from the mortal wound in his chest. Marco felt his heart shatter. His best friend was dead, having given his life for him.
"No, no, no!"
Elisabetta cried, her head against Sandro's chest. His blood stained her face and smeared her cheeks. Marco forced himself to think through his agony. The train left, undoubtedly to avoid trouble. Men and women fled the platform into the station. He had killed two Nazis. More would come soon. Marco had to get Elisabetta out of here. He didn't know where or how. He put his gun away, shouldered his backpack, and looked around, frantic. The tracks began to rumble. A freight train appeared, southbound. Its locomotive was a dark shadow barreling towards the station. It was several tracks over, traveling too fast to be stopping in Modena. It was their only chance. Marco grabbed Elisabetta by the shoulders. "Come with me."
"No, no."
Elisabetta wouldn't let go of Sandro. She sobbed, holding his body, even as his chest bled. "We have to go.
I can't leave him. I won't.
We have to. Now." Marco yanked Elisabetta from Sandro and threw her over his shoulder, crying and screaming. He jumped off the platform with her and hurried across the tracks. The freight train roared toward them. Its horn blared, warning him off the tracks. Marco scanned the cars in the train. The first few were wood with closed doors. Then he spotted a coal car with an open top and a ladder on the side. The freight engine reached them and churned past at speed. Its locomotive thundered, but it slowed slightly as it approached the station. He tightened his grip on Elisabetta. Wind, dirt, and smoke blasted his face. Marco readied himself. Elisabetta screamed. The train roared. The coal car zoomed closer. He launched himself at the ladder, holding Elisabetta. Chapter 134. Marco. 18th of October, 1943. The train hurtled south, barreling through the night, and Marco and Elisabetta lay atop the hard coal. He held her as she wept, her body racked with sobs. The roar of the train deafened him, and it sped through town after town. Wind flew over them, sending coal particulate everywhere, stinging their eyes and filling their nostrils. Coal smudged their clothes and covered their arms, turning them both black, as if they'd become the hue of mourning. Marco looked up at the sky, agonized over losing Sandro. The clouds concealed the moon and the stars. All he could see above was darkness, impenetrable. He wondered where the blackness ended, or if it ever did, like grief itself, having no bottom, top, or sides, but was limitless, borderless, surrounding him. Elisabetta wept, and Marco felt her anguish, for he had gone to Fossoli to get Sandro for her. She loved Sandro, and Sandro loved her, and they belonged together. Marco had planned to sacrifice himself for Sandro, but his plan had failed. Instead, Sandro had sacrificed himself for Marco. The wrong man had died, and Marco knew it. He gazed up at the black and empty sky. He closed his eyes and saw the same void. he cried with Elisabetta, all the way to Rome. Chapter 135. Marco, 19th of October, 1943. Marco slumped at the kitchen table, heartbroken. Coal dust covered his clothes and stung his eyes. His mother set another cup of coffee in front of him. She had cried with him after he told her what had happened in Modena. She looked utterly drained and exhausted, still in the black dress she had worn to his father's wake. Emedio sat at the table in teary silence. Elisabetta was still in the bathroom, sobbing in the bathtub. His mother sat down next to him, touching his arm.
Marco, drink your coffee.
I don't want it, thanks.
You gave your all. You can't blame yourself. Sandro wouldn't blame you. He loved you.
Emedio nodded, equally drained.
I'm sorry, brother.
Marco sipped his coffee, which did nothing to wash down the coal particulate, an irritant he couldn't ignore. Grief, guilt, and rage formed a bolus that lodged in his throat. He looked across the table at his brother.
Oh, Emedio, how nice. And will you pray? Will you pray for Sandro?
Emedio blinked.
Of course, I have been.
And what good did it do? What good did your prayers do Sandro? What good did they do Massimo, or the other Jews, or Papa, or Gemma?
Marco, you're upset.
Yes, I am. Why isn't anybody doing anything? If they had, Sandro would be alive. So would Papa and Gemma. Massimo would be here. It's madness. Why isn't anybody stopping this?
Marco found himself rising, his emotions coming to a boil.
Don't give me prayers, brother. Don't give me sympathy. Papa fought for what he believed in. So do I. I would kill every last Nazi with my bare hands. Sandro died because nobody did anything.
No, Emedio said, his tone hushed. You have to look for the love and for God.
Don't be so naive, Marco exploded. There was no love there, only hate. Where was God when the bullet ripped through Sandro's heart? Why didn't God take me instead? I wanted him to.
His mother gasped.
Marco, don't say such things.
Marco, listen to me. Emedio looked up, shaken. Sandro made the choice to save you. God was there in him. Sandro was love, not hate. Don't betray him now. Don't answer the love he showed with hate.
Marco felt stunned by his brother's words. Their impact stopped him.
He felt ashamed to be shouting at his mother and brother on the night of his father's wake. Their agonized expressions told him he was in the wrong. He slumped down into the chair. He felt bewildered, devastated, crushed. His head dropped to his hands. His gaze found the pale stain darkening the floorboards. It was from his father's blood. Behind him, the bathroom door opened, and Elisabetta came out in a fresh dress, her expression stricken.
I want to go home, she said quietly.
Chapter 136. Elisabetta, 19th October 1943. Elisabetta climbed the stairs to her bedroom, numb with grief. Marco had walked her home, but they hadn't said a single word. They existed in a hell that was shared but also somehow private. She reached her bedroom, unlocked the door, then closed it behind her. The bedroom was dark except for a pale moonbeam filtering through the window, so faint as to appear ghostly. Gnocchi and Rico began meowing, part greeting, part protest. Rico remained at the foot of the bed, his shadow as dark as the coal on the train. Gnocchi was visible, with her white fur glowing in the moonlight. Elisabetta felt like crying, but no tears were left inside her. Only an emptiness, and a tearing in her chest that felt like she also had been shot through the heart. She had been shocked when Sandro had dived in front of the bullet. But she shouldn't have been. That was who Sandro was as a man. Marco, too. Each would have given his life for the other and for her, and Sandro had. She began unbuttoning her dress, walking over to her chair. She noticed that her notebook lay open on her desk, which was odd. She turned on the light and saw a note which read,
"Elisabetta, we had one night, but I want a forever of nights. I love you forever. Your Sandro."
Her throat caught with emotion. Tears filled her eyes. She ran her fingers over the handwriting, feeling its indentures. She picked up the open notebook and held it against her chest. She knew that she would love Sandro forever. She wouldn't stop just because he was gone. She found herself walking to the back door and up the fire escape. She crossed the garden to her chaise longue and lay down, holding the notebook against her chest. She closed her watery eyes, and in the next moment, she heard a loud flapping and fluttering above her in the sky. She looked up to see hundreds of starlings flying in front of the moon, their silhouettes twisting, turning, and forming all manner of elegant shapes. She knew that the flock was a murmuration, a natural phenomenon not uncommon this time of year, but it was remarkable just the same. Appearing on this heartbreaking night, it felt like a sign from Sandro, as surely as the note she held against her chest. She watched the starlings shift and form elongated parabolas and ellipses, the mathematical shapes that he had loved so well. She realized that Sandro was with her still, and would always be. Even if he was above and she was below, him in the heavens and her on the ground, among her plants and flowers and animals. Together, they were the land and sky, the world entire. And it was a world of love and loss.
Chapter 137. Marco, 19th of October, 1943. Marco, his mother, and Emedio stood in the aisle of the open-air building that held his father's vault at his funeral. Almost 200 mourners filled the place, flowing outside into the sun on both sides. Their body heat and the humidity of the afternoon intensified the cloying fragrance of the bouquets lining the wall. It made Marco almost woozy. He hadn't slept at all last night, experiencing an emotional exhaustion that nevertheless rendered sleep impossible. His father was to be buried in one of the gray marble vaults that lined the aisle on both sides, stacked five high. Each was a meter square and about 3 meters deep, containing a coffin. A bronze plaque was affixed to the front, engraved with the name of the deceased and dates of birth and death, which Marco couldn't read. His father's plaque wasn't ready, so Nino had put up a piece of paper with his father's name. Marco couldn't help but feel that his father deserved so much more. The vaults reminded him of the file cabinets at Palazzo Venezia. His mother stood beside him, having cried throughout the funeral mass, leaning against Emedio. Marco had barely listened to the mass, though he had knelt and responded when required, then borne his father's pall and accepted condolences from the mourners. They had included the partisans, veterans of the Great War, his father's old friends from cycling, their neighbors, bar regulars, vendors, hospital employees, ex-fascists, and tifosi. The tifosi referred to his father by his proper name, Giuseppe Terrizzi, having read about him, collected his pictures, and memorized his race times. "He could have been one of the greats," one of them had said. "He was," Marco had blurted out, and had fallen silent for fear of saying the wrong thing. It was all he could do lately, the wrong things. His plan had failed,
He had gotten his best friend killed. Elisabetta had come to the funeral today, which he appreciated, but he couldn't look her in the eye. He didn't know how to go on. He mourned Sandro, his father, Gemma, and Aldo. His grieving heart heaped one loss on top of the other, and their collective weight buried him. After the cemetery, there was a family luncheon at Bar Girosport, during which Marco could barely speak. His presence was in body only, and his actions were mechanical. He ate little, then cleared the tables, and when it was over, he knew what he had to do. He crossed to his mother's side, placing a hand on her arm.
Mamma, may I be the one to go tell Rosa?
Marco walked down the hospital corridor. He had spent so much time in a military uniform that the civilian suit felt strange on him. It occurred to him that a suit was a different sort of uniform, one of a successful man, and if so, he wore it as an actor does a costume. He wasn't successful at anything. He had failed, and now he would have to tell Rosa that her brother was dead and her father left behind. He reached the end of the hallway in a closed door with a glass window. He had already told Dr. Cristabello about Sandro and Massimo, which had saddened him. Dr. Cristabello had told him that the hospital was maintaining its syndrome K story in case the Nazis came back. Marco looked through the window and spotted Rosa, resting in a bed near the window. He put his hand on the knob, but stopped when he caught sight of his own reflection in the window. He looked haunted, like a ghost trapped in the glass. How could he tell her that he had gotten Sandro killed? He would have to find the strength for her. He would tell her about her brother's bravery and his sacrifice. Marco opened the door. Chapter 138. Massimo. 22nd of October, 1943. Massimo perked up, thinking that being of such short stature had paid off. Families from the transit camp were being transported in a wooden freight car, otherwise used for farm animals. There was a splintered slat partway up one side, which made a small opening, and Massimo kept his nostrils to the hole, breathing fresh air. It was a lucky break, for the stench was nauseating, since everyone had to defecate and urinate in the corners of the rail car. The trip was nightmarish, spent in total darkness. Massimo hadn't eaten in days, and neither had anybody else. He was so thirsty he felt woozy. Once or twice his knees buckled, but there wasn't room to fall, and his sprained ankle throbbed. Children had stopped asking for food and water, but babies kept crying, a heart-wrenching sound. An infant near him had died in her mother's arms. He dozed standing up, but he peeked through the opening from time to time. He could see where they were going, and it was mostly country, then mountainous, undoubtedly the Alps. He didn't know their destination, but he assumed it was northward, as the air had grown progressively colder, then frigid. Everyone in the car was accustomed to a warmer climate and dressed too lightly. Again, Massimo counted himself lucky, since he still had on his suit jacket and was the only man wearing a tie, which he regarded as the last vestige of his dignity. The rhythmic clacking of the wheels began to slow down. Massimo sensed they had reached southern Poland. He guessed that they would be at the labor camp, as he had heard rumors that the other ghetto Jews were being sent there too. He brightened, hoping there would be food and drink. Perhaps the Nazis would let them rest before they put them to work. The rumor was that the name of the labor camp was Auschwitz. Massimo hoped that the camp would need a lawyer. He resolved to make his profession known to the powers that be. He felt certain that even Nazis would see his value and use him for billing, ledger keeping, or the like. He had always managed to turn every disadvantage to an advantage. This time would be no different. People started noticing the train was slowing, and they burst into nervous chatter and frightened tears. Families clung together, but Massimo felt lucky again that his family had been spared the labor camp. Sandro had gotten away from Fossoli just in time.
The Nazis had found the dead guard, but hadn't known who had escaped. The very next morning, Massimo and the other Jews had been marched to the station at Carpi, herded onto the freight trains, and sent north. Massimo's heart filled with relief to think of Sandro, Gemma, and Rosa in Rome, safe at the hospital or with the Terrizzis. As a father, he could be at peace only if he knew his family was safe and content. He knew he could count on Beppe to take care of Sandro, Gemma, and Rosa until he got back from Auschwitz. Massimo hoped his stint in the camp would fly by quickly. If he had to perform manual labor, he would endure. He had survived fascism, and he would survive Nazism. The war would end, and his family would be reunited in Rome, where Simone's had lived for centuries. The train was grinding to a stop. Massimo put his eye to the opening to see what was happening. It was dark, but in the distance, there was light.
Chapter 139. Elisabetta. November 1943. Elisabetta worked alone in the restaurant kitchen, since it was too early for the others to arrive. She was making angel hair pasta, folding egg into the dough, then kneading it. It softened and warmed in her palms, almost like a living thing, a human heart shaped with her fingers. She grieved Sandro, but kept it to herself. She couldn't stop thinking of how violently he had died. She couldn't make peace with leaving him at the train station. Sometimes she remembered the happy times, sitting with him at La Sapienza, or remembering their first kiss on the riverbank. Whether she thought of the happy times or the sad, she cried nevertheless. It struck her as a paradox that either happiness or sadness summoned tears. She sprinkled more flour across the dough, then resumed kneading. She still had a business to run. She went to work every day, scrounging for supplies from vendors, bargaining with the black marketeers, and balancing the ledger book. She had come to understand that suffering was a part of war, part of life. Everyone was suffering. The men, women, and children of the ghetto had yet to return. She missed Massimo, Gemma, the Diorios across the street, and her Jewish customers who had vanished that day. She didn't have the heart to go back to the ghetto. She couldn't face the emptiness there. She kept kneading, almost finished. She didn't want to overwork the dough or let her thoughts run away with her. Since Sandro's death, the Nazis had grown more oppressive and violent, and every day they issued new orders. Arrests and beatings in the street became commonplace. Everyone prayed for salvation, believing the Allies would be here by winter, but it was almost Christmas. More refugees arrived every day, displaced and starving. She dusted flour from her hands and her thoughts turned to Marco. He was the only person who understood how awful she felt, and he felt the same way. He worked at Bar Girosport with the same numb sense of duty that she had. He would come by the restaurant once or twice a week, and she had begun to teach him to read. She had started with his name and they had drilled and drilled. She didn't know why he couldn't read better, but she knew he was trying. Elisabetta wiped her hands on a dishcloth. She headed for the tiny bathroom off the kitchen, shut the door, and used the toilet. When she pulled up her underpants, she noticed that they were still white and unstained. Her menstrual period was overdue. She had never been late. Until now. Chapter 140. Elisabetta. December 1943. A month later, Elisabetta was leaving the kitchen, drying her hands on her apron. She entered the dining room, which was empty except for Marco, who sat alone at a table, ready for his lesson. The restaurant had closed for the night. and she and Marco had fallen into a comfortable routine. He would come at the end of his work day, and she would give him a practice sheet of reading and writing exercises, then clean up the kitchen while he finished. He would wolf down a plate of the day's pasta while he wrote, and tonight nothing was left of his favorite dish, spaghetti al cacio e pepe, spaghetti with pecorino romano cheese and pepper. Elisabetta approached the table, and Marco's head was bent over his practice sheet. He had on a wool sweater with his slacks, and his dark, thick hair caught the light from the fixture above the table. He concentrated mightily, squeezing the pencil and holding his tongue to the side, like he used to when he was in school. "How's it going?" Elisabetta asked, sitting opposite him.
"I just finished. Show me."
Marco turned his practice sheet around so she could read it. The letters were oversized but legible. Marco Terizzi.
"Bravo," Elisabetta said, delighted. "You did it."
Marco smiled with obvious pride.
"I took too long, didn't I?"
"No, that doesn't matter. It's not a race."
Marco snorted.
"No, a race is easy. Writing is torture. I did my other practice sheet, too."
"Already? Let me see."
"Hold on."
Marco slid a piece of paper from his backpack, then set it down in front of her. In his oversized and imperfectly formed letters, he had written,
"Marry me, Elisabetta."
She gasped.
"Marco, what's this?"
"Should I read it to you? I can. My mother helped me."
Marco's expression grew serious, his dark eyes earnest.
"Elisabetta, I love you, and I always have. I know that Sandro was your first choice, and I loved him too."
Elisabetta felt a wave of grief and guilt, as if she were betraying Sandro even to listen to Marco's proposal. But she didn't interrupt him.
"I admit, in the old days, I used to hate being second best to anyone, even him. But that's not true anymore. That was ego and pride, not love. None of that matters now. I don't mind being your second choice if, in the end, I get to be your husband."
Elisabetta felt so many emotions she couldn't sort them. Her heart responded to his words. So much had happened since the first time he had asked her to marry him at the Orange Garden. She had chosen Sandro over him, and she was carrying Sandro's child, though she wasn't showing yet. She felt embarrassed, having no idea how to tell him about the baby.
Elisabetta braced herself. "Listen, there's something you don't know."
"I know that you're pregnant."
"What? How?"
"I've been looking at you since you were little. I see the changes.
Your dress is tight around the waist, and your face looks fuller in the cheeks and chin."
Marco reached for her hand, caressing her fingers.
"You think I couldn't tell? I can tell. I've been looking at you your whole life."
Elisabetta didn't know what to say. She felt ashamed, but also seen and understood.
"It's Sandro's."
"Of course it is, Cara. I remember you were with him that night. You told me."
Marco smiled softly.
"I know it won't be easy so soon after losing him. But we can help each other. We both lost him, and we both loved him. That's what I've been thinking, and it's helping me. It gives me strength and hope and a future."
Elisabetta felt her heart fill with happiness.
"But would it bother you to raise Sandro's baby?"
Marco squeezed her hand, meeting her gaze directly.
"I want to raise Sandro's baby,"
There's nobody better than you and me to raise this baby.
Elisabetta felt speechless. Marco had always been that way, surprising her. And now he seemed more mature, even insightful.
Elisabetta, isn't this what Sandro would have wanted? For you and me to get married, to love each other, and to raise his baby as our own.
Marco's eyes filmed, his expression soft but urgent.
I promise you, I will love his child as I loved Sandro. I love the baby in his honor.
The emotion on Marco's face was raw, and Elisabetta felt as if he were opening his heart and soul to her.
And you know what else I think, Elisabetta? In every relationship, there's one who waits. Once I told you that I would have waited forever for you. But I wouldn't have back then. I was impatient, proud, cocky.
Elisabetta smiled, surprised that Marco could acknowledge as much.
Well, I'm different now, and everything's different now. I feel different inside. It broke me, all of it. I lost my brother, my father, my best friend. Hell, Elisabetta, I lost a war. I was wrong about Mussolini, and about so many things. It humbled me.
Marco rose, walked to her, and lowered himself to one knee.
Look, I wait now. I will wait for you, as long as it takes. I believe that someday you'll love me the way I love you. Not yet, maybe not when the baby's born, but someday. And I can wait.
Elisabetta felt a wave of love for him. And Marco held her gaze, put his hand into his pocket, and produced the diamond ring he had offered her before. The gem caught the light, aglow.
Please keep my ring this time. Please be my wife. I love you with all my heart.
Marco met her eye.
Will you marry me?
And Elisabetta answered, her heart soaring. Yes. Chapter 141. Maria, January 1944. Maria thought the wedding meal looked perfect. Rigatoni with pomodoro sauce, then grilled lamb with roasted potatoes and fresh carrots, with fresh parsley, basil and tomatoes from Elisabetta's garden. Only immediate family was present, and Maria had been pleased to host in the dining room at Bar Girosport, which had been closed for the day, this time for a happy occasion. Rosa wore a nice blue dress, sitting next to Emidio, who had performed the ceremony at the church, which had been beautiful. Emidio had blessed the meal and poured sparkling wine into the glasses, but no one was quite sure who was giving the toast, as Elisabetta had no parents and Beppe was gone.
Excuse me, Maria rose, smoothing down her fancy dress. I thought I should say something. Someone should on this day. I'm not one for toasts and speeches. I never made one in my life. But I think someone should speak, from my generation.
She paused, composing herself.
Beppe didn't like speeches either. I know what he would have said today, but I won't say that. He would have kept it short. I can't keep it short, but I can keep it simple. I'll say what I think, and that's all I can say.
Everyone looked up at Maria, and their smiles were encouraging. She probably should have discussed this with them before, but she hadn't known if she would have the courage when the day of the wedding came. As it turned out, she didn't, but she stood up anyway.
I look around the table on this happy occasion, the wedding of two wonderful young people, Marco
and Elisabetta. They love each other. We're so happy for them. We love Marco, and we welcome Elisabetta to our family. Marco and Elisabetta smiled, perfect together. Marco was so handsome in his dark suit and tie. Elisabetta looked radiant in the wedding dress that Maria had given her, which she had worn when she married Beppe. Elisabetta had been proud to wear it, and Maria had been happy that her new daughter-in-law had felt that way. The past had been forgiven. The Mass was beautiful, Emidio. We are grateful for God's blessing on this marriage. We are happy today. Maria paused, mustering her confidence for what came next. Yet I look around the table, and I see eyes with tears, smiles that shake. Our hearts are broken, deep inside. We suffer. So many of the people we love are missing. Beppe, Aldo, Massimo, Gemma, Sandro, Nonna, Lodovico, Serafina. Friends and neighbors, people we loved very much. People we have lost. We are missing them. They are not here, but we are. We don't have to pretend that this occasion isn't bittersweet. Maria noticed Rosa look down, trying to stay in emotional control. Rosa was living in the Vatican, but Massimo had yet to return from the labor camp, and there had been no word of him. Maria cleared her throat. Not all of you know me well. I'm always in the kitchen. I'm in the kitchen at the restaurant, or I'm in the kitchen at the apartment. I guess I never leave a kitchen, whether downstairs or upstairs. Everyone chuckled, which Maria hadn't expected. I'm not a fancy chef or a pasta professoressa like our Elisabetta, my wonderful new daughter-in-law. Elisabetta smiled up at her. And Bar Girosport is a bar, not a restaurant. I was hired as a cook because I worked for free. Everyone chuckled again, which made Maria happy. She realized that giving a speech was just talking to people and telling the truth, a notion that gave her the courage to continue. I mean to say, I'm only a normal cook, like every mother, every woman. And every day, before every meal, I open the refrigerator and I see what I have. I'm always missing ingredients I really need and really want. I'm missing them all the time. That's never been more true than now, with the war. So every day, before every meal, my question is the same. What can I make with what I have? Maria nodded, feeling the truth of her words. I ask myself that question every time I start to cook. I always have, even when the boys were little. What can I make with what I have? Marco, Elisabetta, and Rosa were listening attentively.